Welcome to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club Studios and the EAA Chapter 84 podcast. I'm your host, David Weber. We are back finally this month with another fantastic podcast. Our guest this month has been a member of the chapter for over 10 years and should be a familiar face to anyone who regularly attends the general meeting. Some might say he stands above most other members in both participation and stature. I am, of course, talking about our own Mark Morse. Mark talks with us about his unique path to finding his aviation passion, how that path led him to choose the airplane he is currently close to completing, and some of the trials and tribulations along the way to where he is now. Once again, we conclude the podcast as I bring you the latest chapter news, including updates on meetings and events. Please, if you are enjoying these podcasts, I would encourage you to subscribe to the EA Chapter 84 podcast. Doing so helps keep this podcast going, but more importantly, it will help you know when a new podcast is available. We'll be right back with our Mark Morse conversation after a quick break. Well, welcome to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club Studios, and this month I am honored to bring to you one of a long extended chapter member, Mark Morse. Welcome to the studios, Mark.
Thank you.
So let's get right into this. Kind of tell our listeners here where you grew up. It's a mystery to me. If I had to guess, I'd say someplace exotic like the Bahamas, but maybe I'm wrong on that.
Well, it is sort of exotic, but not the Bahamas.
Okay.
Central Montana.
Oh, great.
An area surrounded by mountains called the Judith Basin, named by Lewis and Clark. One of them had a girlfriend named Judith.
Oh, so I didn't know that. See, history lesson right there.
Yeah, right there. So a lot of the place names there were came from Lewis and Clark. But Granddad homesteaded there and filed his paperwork in 1908, and the farm's been in the family ever since. My dad took it over.
How many acres?
Well, that's hard to say.
Approximately.
You know, a couple thousand.
Wow. So you had some land to play on when you were growing up, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Play. Dad says, here's a tractor. Go play in that field. started out with 160 acres, the homestead.
Oh, wow.
The original act. And Granddad did pretty well. He was able to buy up other homesteads when the guys decided they didn't want to be farmers or went broke and left or whatever.
Right, right.
And so it grew. It was, you know, fairly stable when I was, you know, like elementary school. But then when I was in junior high, Dad bought another farm. A guy without kids.
Because you were bored, didn't have enough work to do.
Right.
Yeah.
The guy didn't have kids, so he sold it and retired to some warm place like Arizona. But the thing is, like anything else, everything gets more expensive and you need more.
Right.
And it's continued since then. My brother's on the farm now. And he's got what Dad had, and he's bought a couple of adjacent farms over the last, you know, 20, 25 years.
So how many siblings do you have?
There were six of us. Granddad had six kids, and then Dad had six kids. And unlike they do in Ireland or England, typically only one sibling stays on the farm. They don't divide it until it's too small to be any good. So the rest of us had to go find jobs somewhere else.
So the brother that's running it right now, is he the youngest?
The oldest.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. First dibs.
Right. Yeah.
it's interesting. So Dad came from a family of six. Mom was an only child.
And, oh,
wow. They met. She went to nursing school and was in college with Dad's sister, and then she was working the bloodmobile, and they'd come to Denton and draw blood, and Dad was always, you know, giving blood, and
he probably gave so much that he passed out. There's a really cute girl that's doing the blood draw.
He was kind of a prankster, jokester, and he would, you know, you got to walk from one room to the other room, from the donating to the cookies and stuff afterward, and pretend to faint in the doorway or something. But
whatever it takes.
Yeah. So they got married in 52, and had six kids, and I think, partly because mom was an only child, she was concerned about all of us kids being treated equally. Oh. She tried hard not to have favorites. However, all of the siblings will tell you that I was the favorite.
Were you the youngest?
No, I'm number four of six.
Oh, okay.
And I never thought I was favored, but... you know, maybe there were some things that I got to do that the others didn't, but
maybe because you weren't trouble.
Yeah, that's my answer. Yeah. You know, we were all about 20 months apart. I have a brother that was behind me, a year behind me in school.
Yeah.
Most of us were every other one, but he was a year behind me. And he liked to push the envelope. It's like curfew. It's like curfew plus 5 or plus 10. And, you know, just it's like,
Mom and dad knew they could trust you. They said, be home at 11. You were home at 10:58, right?
Or 9. Because, the farm life.
Right.
You got up, you did chores. Mom woke up the chore boy when she got up at 6 to make breakfast. And breakfast at 7. So you had an hour basically to get your act together and get chores done. And that was pretty common. And, you know, went off to college and kind of kept the same hours, sort of. So I wasn't, the late night party animal kind of person. I was,
So did any other siblings continue with farming other than obviously your oldest brother, or did everybody kind of go off and do college and get married stuff?
They mostly did other things. My sister, older sister, was valedictorian high school in a class of about 25.
Still.
So still, she worked at it.
It's on the resume.
So she went. It was kind of interesting. To me, it may be heartbreaking to her, but she went to Montana State in Bozeman, and went into mathematics. And basically failed out. That's kind of what I thought too, but and so she shifted and changed her degree to some maybe economics, something a little less intensive, and then while she was in college, she got a job at the local bank as a teller, and was there when the bank examiners came through and examined the bank that they do every year or something like that, and thought that was a cool job. So she graduated college, and unfortunately that was a downturn in the economy and they weren't hiring, so she got a job at another bank in Kelso, Washington, where our great aunt lived.
The connection to come out here.
Well, the other thing is that Portland was the hiring center for the Northwest for the bank examiner, so just 40, 50 miles or something, so it's close and easy to go interview when the time comes.
So did, in high school in Montana, you said that there was 25 in her graduating class. How many in yours?
27.
Wow.
I think the record for the high school was 33 or 34.
And so, did you have to walk uphill both ways to get to school? My dad had to do that.
Yeah, snow was like knee deep all the time too.
Yeah.
So a little side note. So my great aunt in Kelso went to the Presbyterian Church, and she was widowed, had been for quite a while, and was one of those people that was a grandmother to everybody.
Oh, okay, yeah.
You know, she adopted
unconditional love to anybody she met, right?
Yeah, just sort of adopted any attached person, and they had hired another college graduate as a youth director, and my sister and the youth director got to be really good friends, same age, just out of college, and they started doing things together. They left, you know, about the same time, went to other cities and other jobs, but they stayed together, and they would take vacations every year together. After I graduated, I ended up moving out to the Seattle area, got a job with Washington State DOT.
Okay.
And occasionally I would get a call from these two gals saying, hey, can you pick us up at the airport or drop us off? We're going to, you know, some exotic vacation. And so I met this person, and she went back, you know, spent Thanksgiving with our family one year. I was in Calgary with a college friend at Thanksgiving that year. But so I knew this person for quite a while, and eventually I convinced her to marry me. So
I like how you approach that.
Yeah. It's
she was quite reluctant, but you managed to convince her.
Yeah, it only took like 12 years. Right? Well, see, you know, and when she tells the story, you know, I was a freshman in college.
Okay.
And these two gals had just got their jobs, you know, in the real world in Kelso. And I went out there and spent spring break with my sister. She's working as a teller and had, you know, the banker's hours 9 to 3 or something. And so it's like, hey, Terry, entertain this guy during the day, because, you know, her job was more evenings. And it's like, oh, you know, the snotty little brother from still in college, a freshman, no less. And it's like, you know.
Just, so it wasn't exactly a warm relationship right off the bat. It was more of a annoyance to her that she had
kind
to
of. It's just more of the background noise, you know. But So she would still go back down to Kelso and visit the great aunt occasionally. Mm-hmm. The great aunt's family was mostly in northern Oregon, the Dalles, Hood River.
Okay, I know where that.
And so, you know, being the matriarch of the family, she hosted Easter every year.
That's
everyone
where you
would
go.
Come and Easter, and she was the closest family I had living up here in Seattle. So, I would go and spend Easter there too. And so, occasionally, you know, I'd bump into Terry down there. So we knew each other. But we didn't do a lot together.
Right.
But then, my sister got married in Montana. And I told her that, you know, I'm going to be there. I can do things, help out. And Terry was part of the wedding party. I think she was the musician sort of thing. So she was doing music. And it's like, okay, well, my sister is focused on one guy. Doesn't know what anyone else is doing. But, you know, it's
right.
She's going to get married. And, you know, the rest of us, I don't know, I was there a week, I think. Got to do something with your time. And, you know, so Terry and I ran some errands for the wedding. You know, you go to town and get something, pick it up, whatever. And then staying at my parents' house, we're Sunday breakfast after the wedding. Kind of a...
And where was Terry staying?
I don't remember. But not, I think in the same... In the family home.
Okay.
And Dad goes, you know, the jokester that is, why don't you take, you know, your out-of-town friend and go hike Square Butte, one of the mountains that surround the Judith Basin there where we lived.
And how long of a hike is this?
Well,
as long as you want to make it?
Yeah, okay. Pretty much. I think it's an old volcano.
Okay.
That's been eroded away, kind of like Devil's Tower.
Okay.
It's not quite that dramatic, but it's a very, you know, picturesque, very identifiable shaped mountain. And, you know, so we weren't very organized. It took us a while to get there. We packed the lunch and drove up there. And, you know, it's, you got to go through a farmer's pasture or two to get there and the opening gates and whatnot. It just took a little while. And and it's not like around here where there's a trailhead, the big sign and a map, you know, this
oh, okay. Just, so almost just, like you blaze your own kind of.
Yeah, kind of. So we walked up part way. It's really kind of interesting. It's kind of a jagged, rocky ridge, kind of a razorback kind of ridge. And we went up part way up that, you know, on one side where it's kind of smooth and you could walk along. And then we came to a place where you could scramble up and look over this, there between this big spires and out across the farmland. And I think we were high enough, I could think, pretty well pick out where the house was.
Wow. So it sounds like a good hike.
Yeah, it was a good hike.
And you were still in college at this time?
No.
Oh, this time you were out.
I was out. I had a job here.
Where did you go to college at?
I went to Montana State.
Okay. And graduated with?
Civil engineering, bachelor's degree.
Okay.
On the five-year plan. I didn't know what I wanted to do when I went to college.
Most people don't.
Yeah. So I took the classes that looked like fun to me. You laugh, yeah. Math, physics, some of that kind of stuff. And I'd done well in English in high school. And it's like, you know, some English, you know, English covers a whole lot of things. And some I just don't care for. Okay. And some of it was interesting, but some of the stories that you read, that kind of stuff. And so I went to the registrar's office, wherever, and I asked him if I really have to take all of these English courses as, you know, part of the curriculum for engineering. And they said, well, no, you can challenge.
Okay.
And, you know, they give you a 2-hour, 3-hour test, something like that. And if you pass the test, then they gave you credit for the English class. So I went and did that and, you know, passed the test.
And we were able to do it.
And while I was there, I was talking to him and I said, yeah, the career placement people will give you an aptitude test, which is kind of, you know, asks a bunch of disjointed questions and figure out what kind of things interest you. And
did aviation come up at all?
I don't think so, which is kind of weird.
Yeah.
But I remember that typesetter for like a newspaper. It's like, I'm not
That's
sure
what that.
But with a good English background, maybe it's. But civil engineering showed up. It's like, I kind of know what that is. I'll try that.
Try that. And that's what you started directing towards that at that point?
Yeah.
So had you had any aviation inclination by this point? Were you flying airplanes?
We should back up.
Okay.
I found out later, years later, that Dad and his brother and two of the neighbor boys had gone together and bought an airplane after World War II.
Oh. Do you know what kind of airplane?
I don't.
Okay.
Dad had served in the occupational forces in Europe. So he was there like 46 and 47.
Okay.
And then came back to the farm. And somewhere along the way, Granddad had inherited a house that was in South Dakota. So Dad and a brother and then one of the neighbor kids drove the old truck back, took the house apart, and hauled it to Montana and put it back together. Things are a little different in those days.
Try that today.
Yeah. So going through the photos that Dad took, there's pictures taken from the plane of the house being constructed in 47 or 48. So there's a couple of pictures taken from the airplane and a couple of pictures of the airplane, but not, you know, really good pictures.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure it was a high wing, and it had kind of a rounded cowl that came to a point at the spinner.
Hmm.
You know, like the Cessnas are kind of square on front. And so it doesn't look like anything that I recognize today.
It wasn't obvious.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, we'll have to think about that. But
yeah.
So they flew this back around the property?
They put a hangar in one of the neighbor's fields, pasture, and they, you know, they just land on the grass and farmers have, you know, a busy season, and then they have the off season, and so during the busy season they're busy farming, and so they think they use it most for joyriding, if you will, in the off season.
But usually there, the off season is 3 feet of snow, not 8 feet of snow, right?
Yeah, can be kind of cold and nasty. And, the pictures they took of the house, I think there's snow on the ground. So probably, you know, fall or spring.
Right.
But I don't know. So the story is that somebody left the plane parked outside. They didn't put it in a hangar. Hailstorm came along, and that was the end of that. Yeah. But Dad said, it probably doesn't matter. The roof on the hangar maybe wouldn't have stopped the hailstorm. Anyway, it's gone. So, and I think that was probably in the late 40s. He got married in 52, and I think the plane was gone by then. I don't think.
So was there anything that followed up after when you were a child, when your dad, there was no aviation growing up? Nothing like that. But your dad had a little bit of an interest in aviation.
Yeah, he had some experience.
Did you ever go to air shows or anything? Did your dad take you to air shows or airports or anything like that growing up?
Not that kind of thing, no. Huh. Vacation on the farm usually came with a rainy day. You know, it's too wet to work, so go. And typically went to the mountains for a picnic. And occasionally...
Yeah, there was no Disneyland kind of type, yeah.
No.
Yeah.
There was a fair in Grand Falls, but that's aimed towards agriculture.
Right.
And, you know, they had a midway and rides and that kind of stuff. So, but there's a military base, an Air Force base in Great Falls.
Okay.
But I don't remember them ever having an air show, particularly. Huh. And, you know, Dad was a fairly avid photographer. All the equipment for a darkroom, and he did develop some of his pictures. But I do remember there was a fighter jet that crashed somewhere. I think the pilot ejected and, you know, the plane craters nearby. So he went and took pictures of that. But, but yeah, not a lot of introduction to aviation. But, you know, in that part of the country, there are missile silos everywhere.
Right.
And the Air Force... you know, maintains them. They do stuff all the time. And so there were military helicopters based in Great Falls that were flying over, you know, you'd see them out on the farm.
Yeah.
You know, and there was one for several years. We saw one that flew over at 11:55 every morning.
Like, you know, clock. Like, yeah. You like clockwork. You know, set your watch by it kind of thing. Huh?
Got to head back and get to the base in time for lunch sort of thing. You know, and you know, when you're sitting on the tractor all day long, your mind has a lot of time to do stuff.
Right.
And you think about a lot of things because, you know, steering the tractor, you know, you big open field, you got to miss the fence and turn around and get to the other side. And go that's again. About it. And you go again. Yeah.
Like, they didn't have GPS tracking like they have nowadays. Yeah. So you had to steer it, but it was still straight down the track.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And, you know, Dad had a hired man before he had kids old enough to work. And so he hired his kids every summer.
Right.
And so that's what we did. We did the farming. A lot of days out there just watching the sun go by and thinking about all sorts of stuff.
Okay, so you go to college, graduate from college, you're on track. Okay.
Well, wait. Okay. So I was always thinking, you know, you go drive somewhere, it takes forever in the car, you know, you gotta follow the road. And in I don't know, junior high or so, I expressed an interest in aviation. And my parents wanted their kids to have those experiences. And they
They were supportive.
They were supportive. And
which is awesome.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I hate hearing those stories where it's like I wanted to fly and mom said, no way. Over my dead body, you're never going to fly. Instead, I like those supportive kind of things.
Right. So I think that it was instead of a high school graduation gift, I can't remember, 76 or 77 in my logbook, when I was either the end of my sophomore year or beginning of my junior year, they said, we've got you some flight lessons with a local crop duster.
Oh, awesome.
Awesome, yeah. So,
did they go out and watch, bring you to the airport and watch it?
I think they probably did the first time.
Okay.
But I think that based on the timing, it maybe was, it probably didn't happen until I was old enough to drive.
Okay.
And I remember, you know, driving myself over there.
Do you remember what plane?
It was a 150.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how tall were you at this time?
6'4", same size as now. I was kind of a little stick. Wasn't quite this heavy, but yeah. I was still a big guy.
6'4" and a 150 is, you're probably...
Yeah, tilt your head a little bit.
Yeah.
But we didn't have headsets in those days, so you know, you can rub your head on the ceiling without any problem. And I don't remember. The other guy was, I think, pretty average, you know, probably 5'10". Yeah. The instructor.
So you fit all right.
Yeah, we fit all right.
Yeah,
and you know it was pretty good.
Was place it a to paved runway?
Yeah,
and all
it
that
was.
Stuff? Okay.
Yeah.
I missed the airport. What airport was it at?
This is Stanford, Montana.
Okay.
It's the airport owned by the county, I think, but you know, a municipal airport.
Right.
One asphalt runway, 4,000 feet. So great for training.
Oh, yeah. Perfect.
Perfect, yeah. The wind blows there all the time, so those turns around the point and S's along the road, whatever.
Yeah.
We're always a little challenging because the wind's blowing.
But that's a great way to learn.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the best way to learn.
Yeah. Yeah, if you had calm, you know, air and clear skies every day, you'd never learn how to fly.
Right. The crosswind landings
you avoid that
always
stuff.
Be scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, there is an agricultural aspect to this, too, mm-hmm. because you're flying over farmland all the time.
Oh, right.
And, you know, you could see, you know, when they cut the wheat, this mm-hmm. is dryland wheat farming mostly, some barley and a little bit of hay. They cut the wheat, they leave, you know, 8-10 inches of stubble.
Mm-hmm. And that eventually gets tilled in. And
yeah, eventually. And in that day, they were tilling summer fallow, so they would crop 1 year, leave it sit and turn it under the next year, and then the year after that it'd be in crop again. And so you could fly over these fields and you would see the ones that were planted. You know, the wheat comes up in the fall an inch or two, and then it gets cold and freezes and disappears. And so it's just looks like a bare field. Yeah. So this guy brought me up through solo. And, you know, as a senior, I'd soloed. Interesting, one of the things that I remember about the first solo
mm-hmm.
Is we went up and did a pattern and a landing. And he said, okay, I'm going to hop out. Just do, you know, three more like that. And it's like, oh, man. Do I remember all those things I'm supposed to do?
Right.
It's like, well, shove the throttle in and off you go. Right. It's like, man, that 150 climbs much better with half the persons in it.
Well, of course it does. Yeah. It's sort of surprising the difference in performance once you kick somebody out.
Right. You know, it did okay with two of us. It wasn't ever near the end of the runway, but noticeably better. And there was a skiff of snow, not enough to impact performance, but enough that you could see tracks in it.
Mm, okay.
So I went around, and I come around for the third landing, and it's like, ha, look at that. A little bit of wind from the south. I'm landing just off the center line, you know, like the left wheel just to the right of the center line. And I've got three, you know, marks in the snow, and they're all within like 3 or 4 feet of each other. It's like...
So you're proud of yourself.
Consistency counts, right? Even if you're off a center line. but it was nice. I mean, it's like, that was so cool to have the snow there.
That's a great feedback, actually.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, hopefully... You would think the feedback would have, and maybe it was true, I was getting closer and closer to the center line with each one because, you know, this instant feedback. But the other fun thing that I remember from training with him was, talking about different things. I asked him if a 150 would do a barrel roll. I said, well, sure. Well, watch this. And he did. But he admitted he was... You know, out of practice, and
kind of fell out of it when he got on top.
Upside down. He was let the nose drop, and we lost some altitude. So we pulled 2 or 3 G's coming back right side up. And he says, "I can't tell anybody about this."
You didn't. You haven't told anybody.
That's right. Well, unfortunately, he passed away several years ago, and so FAA enforcement is going to be whacking, but.
They'll still send him a letter in the mail.
Yeah, right. Then,
so did you continue with lessons or did you drop them after that?
I kind of dropped because, you know, college, right. College was looming. I was, you know, senior, trying to get stuff done in high school. I was on the basketball team. And so, you know, from...
Just life got busy kind of thing.
Yeah. From November through February and March, basketball pretty much consumed my free mm-hmm. time. So, and then, you know, spring ceremonies, that kind of stuff. But, and so, of course, Mom asked what I wanted to be when I grew up. You know, did I want a career in aviation?
Right.
I was like, well, I don't know. So the two of us drove down to Thermopolis, Wyoming, where they had an aviation school.
Okay.
I don't remember much of the interview. You know, we sat down and talked with
right.
someone there. And I just came away thinking that I didn't want to be, you know, so the only thing I could really think of, you know, job-wise in the aviation market was airline pilot or crop duster or freight. And it's like, I don't want to be a crop duster, which in hindsight maybe was a bad idea, but it is what it is. I didn't want to be a, you know, airline pilot. All you do is fly from here to there and take, you know, those disgruntled
right.
passengers
right.
and freight, you know, it's like, well, there's no glamour in that. But so I said, no, I'm gonna get a real job. I'll find something else that I like that mm-hmm. that's, you know, well, that has more job security.
Right. And keep in mind, a lot of people don't realize, maybe most of our listeners, but especially back in that age, you know, the airlines were coming and going. There was a lot of
mergings
and just outright failures. And I mm-hmm. mean, yeah. Pan Am was huge, and then all of a sudden it just was nothing.
Yeah,
you know, these are big failures. So it was a well known scenario or understood that pilots and the airline people in the airline industry, it was a very fragile industry. Is probably mm-hmm. a way to put it.
Right, yeah.
So you're thinking, I want stability. You're not thinking airlines at that point.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and you know, it's kind of a long commute down to Thermopolis. So I decided to go to Montana State. Didn't really want to know what I wanted to do there. But they, you know, being a state school, the land-grant college, they had a wide variety of... what you want to call them, colleges, curriculum, whatever. And so I took the aptitude test, went into civil engineering. They had a flying club based at the Bozeman Airport.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it was great. One of the engineering instructors, I think, was the...
The instructor?
The advisor.
Oh, the advisor.
Each extracurricular
right.
club has to have an advisor. So he was the advisor.
Oh, I see. So this wasn't like a graduating program. It was just a side...
Fly for fun sort of club.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, that's even better. I mean, that sounds like a great, you know, sort of benefit for going to the college.
Yeah. And to me, it was a great attraction.
Yeah.
And they had...
do you know if that is still active today? Do they still do that today?
I don't know.
Huh. That'd be interesting to look into that.
It would. So they had the traditional Piper Warrior 6542 whiskey. And they had... I can't remember if it's an Archer or an Arrow. The next step up, fixed gear.
Okay.
From Piper, and so you know, back in the day, in the early '80s, you could rent 6542 whiskey for $8 an hour.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, did you end up finishing up your pilot license at college when you were in college?
So, went to class in the daytime, flew on evenings and weekends, and managed to get my pilot certificate about a month after I graduated. It's you know, one of those things that it, you know,
right.
As you approach graduation,
right.
Things just go crazy.
Yeah.
And so it's
you got to focus on one thing, and that's getting your finals done and get graduated. And
right.
That kind of a.
And I did that, and I went, phew, yeah. You know, sweat off the brow. Got
my degree. But they still allowed you to go back and pay college rates for your flying?
Yeah, well, it's the club.
Okay.
And
so you don't have to be officially enrolled at that point. Once you graduated, they didn't kick you out is what I'm
right.
getting at.
Yeah. Okay. And I'm trying to think how that worked. My guess is no one checked in the summertime.
Right.
It's like, you know, in the fall
you went to college, you're an alumni now, you can
So then I said, okay, it would be silly to graduate college and leave this close to a
right.
A private pilot and not finish it. So I said, okay, I'm gonna, you know, go talk to my instructor, get some practice in, and schedule time with the examiner and finish it. And I don't know, it, you know, back in those days you could fly for 2 years. We had 2 years after you took the written test to get the proficiency. Right. And I had taken the written test. You know, great deal. It's like 90 miles from Bozeman to Helena.
Okay. And that's where you had to take it?
Yeah. The test. I went to the Civil Aeronautics Board where right. it is in Helena. And it's like, hey, it's a nice day. I flew the Piper over there and parked it on the ramp. And I started taking the test and it's like, oh, the beacon is still flashing on the airplane. It's like, you can't leave that or you'll be dead right. battery. They let me walk out of the test room to the ramp, turn off the master, and walk back in to continue. It's like, you don't get any extra time, but we're going to watch you and make sure you don't pull a cheat sheet right, off from right. seat or whatever. But yeah, passed the test, and then, it was about a month, like early July after I graduated in June.
So did you do anything with this now, or you just got your license and that was that? Did you continue to fly, or what?
I didn't. I did fly a couple of times that summer. I took a brother and a sister on different times and their friends for a flight around the area. But I was more concerned about finding a job.
Right.
Unfortunately, just a little downturn in the economy, and I wasn't able to interview with anybody on campus. I didn't have any prospects.
Wow.
It's like, you know, mom and dad will let you live if you work on the farm. You know,
right.
Got to be gainfully employed. But so I did that. Well, that was my plan. And at that time, Greyhound had a bus pass, a month long. Ride the bus anywhere kind of thing. So I went and bought one of those.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Right.
Rode the bus around the western states and visited all of the relatives.
Right.
You know, stay maybe a couple of days or a week with them or something. And I took, you know, resumes and went to a lot of the state offices.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, either they lived in the state capital or nearby. And you know, we'd go drop off resumes and fill out applications, that sort of thing, including one in Washington. And it's a hard way to find a job, you know, because, you know, if there's an opening they're trying to fill and you can submit an application and get attached to that, you know, you have a chance along with, you know, how many other guys.
Right.
But if you have to wait for an opening to come up, it's like, who knows how long it's going to take. So I spent the month of September doing that. Got home. It's like, working on the farm. What else can I do? But then early January, I got a call from Washington State DOT in Tri-Cities for an interview in a construction job.
Oh. And that's what eventually brought you out here.
Well, I took the interview. I rode the train out, did the interview, rode the train back home. And, you know, and it's mom and dad live 2 hours from the train station. And I got home and walked in the door and they said, oh, about a half an hour ago, Washington called They want you to be in Seattle to interview.
Ah,
if I'd have just known, I could have, you
could
know,
have just stayed.
Could have stayed, yeah. But so it's like, you know, next day, loaded up the car and drove to Seattle, interviewed on Friday. And
did they at least get back to you at a reasonable time? I mean, or did they?
I didn't trust them, so I called late Friday afternoon, and they said, "Yeah, they're going to extend an offer to you."
Okay.
Okay. Perfect. So, basically, drive back home,
pack up your stuff, and move out to Seattle.
Yeah. And you know, kind of the typical college kid. You know, I owned a pickup truck, and I loaded all of my worldly possessions in the back and threw a tarp over it.
Yeah. All right. So, this stage of your life, kind of tell us how you're contemplating either a build or an acquisition of an airplane.
So basically all my needs were met and I had this extra cash in my pocket and you know, kind of a moment of reflection is, what do I want to do in my life that I haven't done already?
I see where you're going with that.
It's like, let's get back into aviation.
Sort of a bucket list kind of a thing.
Yeah. It's like, you know, life is limited. You need to
check
those things. Yeah. So I said that to my wife. She's a sweetheart.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes, oh, well, why don't you join the Boeing Flying Club? It's like, because I don't work at Boeing. She goes, it doesn't matter. They let spouses in. And so it's like, oh, you know, light bulb comes on. Why don't I do that? So I went and talked to the guys at BEFA, Boeing Employees Flying Association. And they said, yeah, sure. And helped me get set up. And that another sweet deal. We couldn't ask for anything better than that. Because we lived in Renton about 12 or 15 minutes from the airport, the BEFA office at the airport. And they had like a dozen planes and a variety. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, whatever you want. And so I found an instructor that got along well with. And I said, you know, here's the deal. It's been about 18 years since I've been in a plane and I just joined BEFA. So what do we do? And I said, I think I need a biennial flight review.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I think you need a little more than
that. Right, right.
And so we took, three or four flights, some ground school. Because they changed all the airspace names and classifications and a bunch of other stuff on the charts.
Right, right. You went from terminals to... Yeah.
Classes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we did that and checked me out and it's like, okay, there you go. You're signed the logbook. You're a pilot again, free to fly whenever. And it's like, wow, now what do I do? I booked myself kind of a round robin flight to orient myself kind of with the Seattle airspace. Flew out of Renton, went over to Bremerton, down to Olympia, past McCord, back to Renton. And so, you know, mostly local flying, a few trips. And then my wife came to me one day in 2003, I think, and said, there's an opening in Chicago at the headquarters office, and I'd like to apply for it. And I'm thinking, she just gave me the okay to join the flying club. I'm not saying no. So I said, okay, sure, let's do that. We'll move to Chicago and you can work there. It it was 3 or 4 months. It was November. They said, okay, we need, you know, you're now in the Chicago office. You need to actually be there. So she found an apartment and moved there. And in March, the moving truck came and loaded up everything we owned and hauled it back there. And in the meantime, she had found a house to rent, a mansion, a 5-bedroom dream home that this guy had built. And then the school board found out his kids didn't live in the school district. And
so
it's either you got to live in the district or
right.
they're out. And so he put his house up for rent and moved back into the district. And
so you guys moved in.
We moved in. And I told her, I said, you know, WashDOT doesn't have any openings in Illinois. You know,
I'm Washington State
Department of Transportation. I'm not going to be able to keep my job. Yeah. And if I cannot find a new job,
right.
I'm going to build an airplane. Got to do something with time, right? Yeah.
So sounds reasonable to me.
Yeah, back when I first got my inheritance, I joined BIFA and I subscribed to Kitplanes magazine.
Okay.
And, you know, every year they have the engine guide and the plans built guide and the,
right.
the home built guide. So I started watching that and, you know, I'm kind of a numbers guy. So I started an Excel spreadsheet and listed all the planes and all the features and attributes and costs and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, most of her career, she had been, well, she'd been with Boeing and she would get a job in a department.
Right.
And be there 3 years, 5 years, something like that, and then get a, you know, an advancement to another department, another group, and just kind of stair step. And it's like, well, you know, that'll probably continue. We'll be in Chicago area for 5 years at least. And if we're going to build an airplane, what better place to do that than at an air park? So we went...
Again, sounds perfectly reasonable to me.
Yeah. We went and looked at houses, you know, found a realtor and looked at houses at all the different air parks around there. And didn't really find anything we liked. Terry's father and her mother eventually, after kids, both had jobs at Boeing. Her dad did 35 or 36 years as a structural engineer. Mm-hmm. And they had pretty much always lived in a new house, you know, the first owners of a house.
Okay.
And that's kind of what Terry's mindset is.
Okay.
And so didn't want to buy a used house. Let's do a new one. And so we ended up south of Chicago, south of Interstate 80 in a little town called Moni, again, a little farming community that is slowly being absorbed into the suburbs.
Right.
But they had a little air park there then, and I don't know, 25, maybe 30% built out. It's a lot of empty lots. And we found a lot we liked and picked it out and hired a contractor and worked with an architect to...
And built a house.
Built a house. Well, you know, they had the house sort of framed in.
Mm-hmm.
And Boeing said, you know, we want Chicago to be the financial and legal headquarters. We don't want any engineering groups in here. So Terry's engineering group, that it coordinates all of the work between Boeing and the external affiliations. So all the alphabet groups, you know, right. AIAA, Society of Women Engineers, all those groups that okay. Boeing interacts with. The interaction sort of is coordinated by the groups she was in. And so all of her work primarily was with engineers in the engineering, you know, design and construction part of the company. And so they looked at St. Louis, San Diego, or Seattle and said, we're going to move the group to one of those locations. And we were happy that they chose Seattle. We came back here.
But you never finished the house?
Well, we went to the builder and said, hey, we're going to be moving. And can we opt out? What are our choices? And he basically said, your choice is to finish the house. It's like, well, okay, we tried. And they did the same kind of thing. They made this announcement in the summer, and they asked the employees to be at their new job site.
By a certain date.
Yeah, by a certain date.
And that was it.
And so we worked with the contractor. So we had spent a lot of time our free time, weekends, looking at finishes. You know, what kind of hardwood floors? What kind of floors? What kind of carpets? All that kind of stuff. All that stuff. We spent all this time. We figured it all out. And then Boeing said, well, you're going to be moving. And it's like, oh, well, we should look at these choices we made and make more generic choices that'll help the house sell better. You know, not everyone likes pink shag carpet, you know. So we spent...
Except Elvis. But
so we spent a bunch more time reversing those. And basically, we lived in the house for 2 weeks. And then...
got the occupy permit and then sold it.
We qualified as the primary residence under Boeing's rules. And so then if we couldn't sell it, they would make the sale happen.
Oh, okay. they buy you out kind of a thing.
Yeah. And so then we loaded up our minivan. And the Wednesday, Thanksgiving weekend, 2004, and headed west. drove to Montana, spent Thanksgiving with my family there, and then drove out here. And people at WashDOT were happy to see me. Hey, you're back to work.
How long were you absent from your position?
From March until December, so about 8 months.
Yeah, not long enough to get building an airplane, that's for sure.
No, that's true.
But did you make a decision during that time?
I did. So I did. I had this spreadsheet figured out.
Right.
And, you know, being a logical person, you keep processing and run through the algorithm of the decision-making tree.
Right.
And meanwhile, there's a little voice inside that said, you should pick that one. But you have to go through the process to justify picking that one.
Right.
Because you don't want to, you know.
You've got data in front of you. Yeah.
So I had taken a flight, a demo flight in a Velocity. And I had taken a demo flight in a, the Italian guys.
Falco?
No. Who are they? They have Technam.
Oh, Technam. Okay.
They had a, I want to say it was like the P2000, very similar to the Ranger that you just showed me out here in the hangar, a Rotax engine.
Mm-hmm.
And I flew that, and it's like, wow, that's kind of cool. You know, no mixture to play with. But, you know, flying back and forth to Montana, faster seemed better. But we were in Chicago, and I said, you know, it would be sad if we were living this close to Oshkosh and didn't go visit. I had never been there. And, you know, we had vacation time.
So
I said, hey, let's go. We'll take our camper. We'll camp at Oshkosh, and we'll see the air show.
And Terry was cool with this.
Yeah, she said, sure, I like vacations. Let's go to the air show. I like camping. So... we drove up. I want to say we left after it was after work. I don't know. It was Thursday or Friday.
Okay.
And drove up there. Got there in the dead of night. It was like midnight. We pull up to the gate, and I'm thinking we're going to have to camp here at the entrance booth until some volunteer comes to work in the morning.
Yeah.
And pull up, and no, there's some college girls in there. It's like, hi, you know, this happy, welcome, smiling faces, like. What can they do for you? It's like, well, we need a campsite. Well, okay, here's the deal. Give them the money, and they give you the wristbands and all that kind of stuff. And they, and, you know, on the edge of a big open hay field, basically. It's like, there are some reserve sites that are inside a red rope or something.
Uh-huh.
And you can have any site that's not already occupied. Okay.
Sounds great.
Driving around in the dark, trying to find an unoccupied spot. And... we just luck of the draw. I mean, I don't even know which way was north.
Right.
Where the air show is, that kind of stuff. But we, you know, there's some people kind of camped already. Here's an empty spot. So we set up camp. And it turns out it's like, you know, maybe a block down to the showers this way and two blocks to the entrance by the Red Barn going that way. It's like, it was a great location.
Perfect spot.
Perfect spot, yeah. So we were there the weekend before the air show starts, so nothing on the grounds was open, really.
So
we went to Pioneer Airport, went through the museum, checked out some other things, and then Monday morning we hit the ground running, all this stuff to see. So I had a short list of aircraft. I said, these are the ones that I think would be best for us. There was a Velocity, there was a Bear Hawk, and I don't remember. I do remember we saw Glass Air. And I can't remember if there's another one or not. But the idea is like all the, you know, this smorgasbord of airplanes, you can
try all their
size. Yeah, they're all there. You can talk to people. You can see what they look like, all sorts of stuff. So, you know, being a tall guy, one of the concerns I had was headroom.
Right.
And so I wanted to, you know, try them on, see how they work. And we went and talked, you know, we spent, you know, an hour or so in each one of these places, asking a bunch of questions, collecting brochures and stuff. And, you know, the guys at Glass Air really wanted me to buy their aircraft. It's like, you know, you want to go fast, you can't get much faster than that. And it's like, okay, well, the fuselage is very short, top to bottom. And so basically you sit on the bottom of the fuselage and stick your legs straight out underneath the instrument panel. And I have long legs. And, you know, geometrically getting them down under the instrument panel was a challenge.
Okay.
You know, you kind of got to turn your knees sideways so they bend and can get under there. And I'm thinking any kind of incident, if you want to get out of the airplane fast, it's not going to happen because you got to maneuver your legs to get them to come out the right way. It's like, nah, I don't want to do that. Went and talked to the Velocity guys, and it's like, yeah, it's a really cool looking airplane. And it goes fast. I wanted a four-seater because, well, you'll think this is weird, but because we never had kids. Because we never had kids, you know, it's just the two of us in a car. We can take all the stuff we want until the car gets full. And that's kind of the way we navigate and travel. And so I knew if we're going to go somewhere on vacation in this airplane.
You were going to load it up.
My wife's going to, load her up. So four seats was good because I got space to put all that stuff. So it's like, it's such a sexy airframe. Why would you buy anything else? So I told the guys I want to put a deposit down and buy one of these things. And
at Velocity, you told them this.
At Velocity, at the air show.
Okay.
Basically, I want to take advantage of your
show special.
Show special, yeah. The unwritten special nobody knows about. Well, so Dwayne, the owner, took me into his luxurious motorhome that was sitting there, air conditioned, and said, let's talk about this. And he asked several kind of pointed questions about how I was, you know, what kind of pilot I was, how I was going to finish this kit, and who was going to do the work, and that kind of stuff. Those sort of reality questions that you need to know the answer to. And he didn't really care too much about the answer. But he wanted to know that I understood what I was getting.
Wanted to get you thinking about this stuff.
And I said, you know, I'm going to build it. Terry's going to help. But, you know, there's some things she likes and some things she doesn't. And so, you know, she's kind of mechanically minded. And so she likes putting the mechanical pieces together. But smearing epoxy and sanding fireglass, not her thing. She's not going to do that. She's an artist. She likes colors and textures and that kind of stuff. So when it comes time to pick a paint scheme, she's going to be a wonderful resource and interior finish. But sand and epoxy, not her thing. It's like, okay, Dwayne of Velocity, Terry, and I all agree that this is how it's going to work. Everyone's happy. So I said, you know, we know we're going to be moving, so it doesn't make sense for you to ship the kit to Illinois so we can put it in a truck and haul it
move
out
it
here,
to Seattle.
Move to Seattle. So, you know, what can we do about that? And basically he said, you know, we're having production problems. So it's going to be a while before we have a kit that's ready for you. And I said, take your time, not a problem. Here's the deposit. We'll pay the rest of it on, you know, on delivery kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And the show special is you get 2-for-1 for the time that you purchase at the build center that they had at the factory.
Oh, okay.
So it's like, okay. Mm-hmm. I mean,
it's something.
It's something. And in my case, well worth the money.
Okay.
So we got a call about a year later that said, hey, your kit's going to be ready soon. What are you going to do with it? And I said, well, let's do some time at the factory, in the build center. And basically, I paid for a week and I got a free week. I probably should have paid for a month and then two, but, you know.
Hindsight.
Live and learn. Yeah, exactly. So I told Terry, you know, when's a good time to go to Florida to the factory? And she said, well, you know, sometime in September would probably work. Where are we going to stay? We have some timeshare condo time in Hawaii. And we don't go to Hawaii very often. So we put it in the bank. And she looked around and found a condo close to the factory and booked us for 2 weeks. So Terry and I spent the first week working on the airplane. And it, you know, it worked pretty well. Scott, who was a part owner of the company, mm-hmm. would come in the morning and talk to us about what we need to do and how to do things and kind of manage the project, if you will,
okay.
for the new guy. And teach us how to mix epoxy, how to spread it, how to know when you're doing a good job, that kind of stuff. And then he would go do other stuff for the rest of the day, and we would work on the airplane.
Start working on
it. Yeah. And they had the fuselage there. It was on the gear. I should mention that I bought the fast build option.
Gotcha.
So they put the bottom and top halves of the fuselage together, set it on the gear. And the wings were still being built somewhere, but okay. at least I had something to work on at the factory.
Right.
So we worked on that, you know, put in the speed brake in the bottom and started doing some other stuff like reinforcing layups for engine mounts and,
okay.
and that sort of thing. And learned a lot about fiberglass work, you know, kind of mechanically how you lay it up. And also he was teaching us how to make the flexible fuel lines out of that braided steel hose, oh, the flexible
right.
hose,
right.
That kind of stuff. So we learned a lot. And then it's like, okay, well, vacation's over, time to head home.
So did you have it trucked back or did you haul it back?
Well, no, it wasn't ready to go yet. The wings weren't ready. They also fast build wings. So basically they build the wing with the winglet on it. Or build
gotcha.
The wing and put the winglet on it. And they also build the canard. So they weren't ready yet. So it's like, well, I sat down and did the math again to see how big a truck you'd have to rent to haul
right.
it. And there was a guy, I think it's Travis Holland, has a company that all they do is move kits.
Yeah.
He's got
airplanes.
A couple mm-hmm. yeah, a couple of specialty
does
trailers.
Vans and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I said, okay, well, you know, in the meantime, we had moved back to Seattle and bought a house at the air park
mm-hmm.
that was framed up. And it's like, okay, still no rush to ship the kit. But so we had moved into the house in July, and then September went down to the factory to do the
right.
start building it, but didn't have a hangar. So what are we going to do? So we had purchased the stuff to build a hangar. We maybe had the concrete part underway.
Okay.
And so I made friends with one of the neighbors in the air park And I said, you know, I got a kit coming. Can I store it in your hangar? He had some room. He could store it for, it was about 6 months or so.
Okay.
Until our hangar was watertight and we could put stuff in it. So then we moved it in to our hangar that summer. So,
and then started working on it out of your hangar.
Well, no. The thing is, building an airplane is quite a project. Building a hangar is perhaps a bigger project. It's a very, very similar sort of thing, but and of course, all these projects take longer than you anticipate.
Of course.
And so, you know, it kind of sat there and got in the way for a while we finished the hangar.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah. So,
and it's hard to build an airplane when you don't have the facilities to do it in. I mean, you can't.
Yeah, right. You can't do both.
No.
You got to kind of prioritize. And there was, so I had built a 3-quarter bath in the corner, and I built a workshop next to it. And they were heated, and the rest of the hangar wasn't. And I was thinking, you know, I can put the fuselage in there or wing or whatever and work on it. And then finish the rest of the hangar. And,
right.
You know, but it didn't work out very well. The workshop wasn't heated very well, and the epoxy is Dow Chemicals. They call it DER-324 is the resin, and then it has a hardener. Mm-hmm. And it's EZ-84 is the quick. Well, maybe it's normal. It's not quick. It's the normal curing hardener, and then EZ-87 is a slow hardener.
Okay.
You know, the factory's on the east coast of Florida, just south of
Canaveral. So they're going to use probably the slower one.
They use the slow stuff because they work in the heat all the time.
Yeah, it's 90.
You know, it's 80 down there today, you know, so it's only going to be, what, 60 here?
Well, yeah, we're walking around in shorts.
Yeah, exactly. So... yeah, they like the slow stuff because it gives them time to do stuff. Because this stuff, it cures faster at higher temperatures.
Right. And so therefore, you need a heated facility because you've got to get the cure.
You know,
correct.
Correct. Yes. So it was like 2009, 2010. It's been in the hangar for like 4 years.
Uh-huh.
And they're in, you know, they delivered a 5-gallon bucket of resin and another 5-gallon bucket that's half full of the hardener with the kit. Because, you know,
right,
you got to give the supplies so the guys can finish. And I thought it would be prudent to mix up some of this stuff in a non-aviation application and verify that it's still good.
Okay.
And so I did that. And I had a wooden box I wanted to seal. So I just painted the epoxy on the outside of the wooden box to seal it. I went back out there the next day. It's sticky.
Ugh.
It's not cured. And I went out there the day after that, and it's still sticky. It's still not cured. In a, you know, 55-degree hangar, whatever it is. And so I'm thinking, well, I'm not doing aviation layups if it takes that long to cure.
No,
not going to happen. So we need to finish the hangar. We had all the stuff. It just took some time, but so we had the airplane in there. We had tools and mm-hmm. scaffolding and a bunch of other stuff. And so we had insulated the walls, kind of as it was built, but we needed to insulate the ceiling. And we could use the scaffolding to do that. It's on wheels.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to have a clear floor space to do it. So
there's something in the way.
There's something in the way. So we kind of reorganized it to clear out as big a chunk as possible so we could run the scaffolding through there and do the insulate the ceiling. And then, you know, shuffle everything into the insulated space from the uninsulated space and run the scaffolding through there and do it all again. And it just takes time.
Oh, yeah.
And I was just chewing my nails. It's like, I need to work on this airplane. Because everybody I know knew I had an airplane.
And they're always asking you.
They're always asking. That's what they talk about. Right. How's the kid coming
along? How's it coming along?
Oh, man, it really bites to have to say, well, it's still sitting there waiting. So
come up with a new excuse.
Yeah. I volunteered to work at the Chapter 84 tent down at the Arlington Air Show.
Okay.
And, you know, you got to have something for show and tell, right?
Right.
So I pulled some of this fast-built kit stuff down there, started with the wings and cutting outlets or the little notches for the hinges on the ailerons. And the first couple of years, the only work that got done was the work that got done at Arlington until eventually we got the hangar to the point where it was heated enough
you could start doing work.
It was done enough that I could stop working on it and work on the...
Yeah.
And so... I don't know, 2015, 16, somewhere in there, the number of hours on the Velocity really ramped up.
Started going up,
yeah. I'm using KitLog Pro to track my hours, track the project, basically. And they have a filter in there where you can sort out hours by year or by the... part you were working on,
right?
That kind of thing by category, and so I've been tracking the number of hours per year. Yeah, it shot way up, and it's been pretty steady. There was a year.
So where are you at now? What's the progress now?
Well, yesterday I attached all of the fire sleeved flexible hoses with the steel braid. So the last month or so, I've been
building,
ripping my fingers apart with that steel braid. So I attached them all. And I've got the control cables all attached to their hard points on the engine. So I've got basically the point where I can put fuel in it.
Great.
I need to time the magneto and the electronic ignition.
Okay.
And then I think I'm ready for engine start.
Wow.
I'm an optimist. I often think things are more ready than they really are. And so I could be off. But so, you know, my life seems to be in sort of a series of somewhat managed accidents, train wrecks, if you will. So
controlled chaos is what I like to say.
Yes, it's much like that. So I thought I was getting ready to be to the point where it was time to bolt the engine on. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do that so that everything would be together and I could do the instrument panel and wiring. And so I thought I was ready and I bought an engine. And I just realized that was 2018. No, it was 19. So it's been sitting in the corner there for 3 years. I was almost ready. and the same kind of thing. Was it right before the pandemic? Was it 18 or 19, 2018 or 19, we went back to Oshkosh so we could go shopping for avionics.
Oh, okay.
And while I was there, I met with this guy who... lives next to the factory in Florida, the Velocity factory.
Okay.
And he started a business basically building instrument panels for Velocity aircraft.
Oh.
And I think
that's kind of neat.
Yeah, it is. The factory, I think, gives him a little corner that he can work in. And he works a lot with the guys in the build center that are building their aircraft there. And so,
sort of a nice little amenity for customers of Velocity, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so he's got a loom laid out where he can run the wiring. He knows,
And that's tricky in a Velocity because the engine's in the back,
And the panel's in the front.
So you got special cables, special harnesses,
right? And, you know, I could do all of this, and I would do it one wire at a time, and I would pull it.
Yeah.
On the second day, I would probably find something like plastic tubing or something I could feed in there. This is where the wire goes and measure that's that long and then cut a spool off and start terminating. It's like, And then, I, you know, if you pull in one wire at a time, you end up with kind of a mess. And I'm not forward thinking enough to identify all the wires and where they go
and lay it out,
bundle them and lay it out and figure out.
Yeah.
But this guy, that's what he does. You know, he did it once, and he's got a big, huge table with lines drawn on it.
Right.
You know, if you need to go to the wing tip, follow this line. If you need to go to the canard tip, you follow that line. Whatever the stuff goes. And he went to the hardware store, and you know, they have these little spring brackets that you can put a broom in to hang it on the wall.
Yeah.
He screwed a bunch of those on the table, and he just slides the wire in there and keeps it tidy while he's...
Wow.
So he builds the instrument panel and a wiring harness. And the idea is that you then slip the thing into the aircraft, and all you have to do is terminate the wires with the equipment in the structure, you know, the lights, the motors, whatever, and you're done.
Yeah.
So I said, hey, I want you to build this for me. And he says, well, it takes about 4 months, typically, with these guys in the hangar to do that. And in my case, it's been, well, we ordered the Dynon parts a year ago, this past January, so it's been a little over a year. But he came, so we ordered in January, you know, pandemic supply chain problems.
Right.
I think it shipped in May or June, something like that. So he had all the parts, spent the summer building it, putting the wiring harness together, that kind of stuff. And then I told him...
Does he power everything up there too? Oh, yeah. So that's nice.
Tests all the cables,
make sure... Put the magic smoke test to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
He does all that stuff.
Oh, that's great. So
when it's in the aircraft...
You get a much higher success rate, yeah.
Yeah, and if there's a problem, it's in the connection to the stuff in the aircraft. It's not the stuff that he did. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, they say that building an airplane has three big bills, you know, the airframe, the engine, and the avionics package, and it's so true.
Yep.
And I'm sorry, I'm the farm kid that thinks spending that much money is crazy.
I'm in the same boat.
But I'll tell you what, working with this guy and having him build a harness was worth the money.
I always go back to that old muffler shop commercial, you can pay me now or you can pay me later, right?
Yeah.
And you turn that switch on and smoke comes out.
That's an expensive lesson.
What does that cost you?
Yeah.
You can pay me now or you can pay me later.
But not even, I mean, even, you know, even if you're careful and you don't let the magic smoke out of the box, but just something doesn't work. You know, your trim motor runs backwards or something.
Right.
You know,
plus all the equipment, all the tools you need, the special crimpers and
all that stuff,
the knowledge and so there is value in paying somebody that has done it before.
Yeah. And the longer I work on this, finishing up this wiring project, the more I realize it's like, oh, boy, I saved a ton of time.
Yeah.
It's, you know, who knows? And
people might not realize this, but the FAA doesn't consider that part of your build. You can actually pay somebody to do it, and it doesn't count against your 51%. Right. Yeah. Avionics is not part of that build. So,
One of the other things that this guy did, he did several things besides the work that he did, but he was always asking me questions. How are you going to do this? What do you want for that?
Yeah.
It made me think it through and figure it out. And about half the time, he would come back and say, well, you know, a lot of guys do it this other way. And we would discuss it and decide which way we're going to do it, my way or the other guy's way. But I would have spent so much time trying to figure this stuff out. And just a little experience there.
Right.
And knowing the implications of some of the decisions you're making. Oh, yes. Well worth it.
So let me ask you this. This is the million-dollar question you get all the time: when do you think you're going to be done? When do you think you're going to be ready to push that thing out?
Yeah, I was hoping that would be like, you know, this week. Mm-hmm. Last summer when he's building the panel, I was hoping it's like, Oh, yeah.
This week.
Early spring.
Yeah.
You know, into March. I told my avionics buddy that he should come in April and we'll finish the wiring of the airplane and basically check his box, get him off the job, make his final payment so he doesn't have to come back and he doesn't have this job hanging on the books for 6 months or whenever.
Right.
I come back to work on it. So my goal was that by April, I would have the engine on there and ready for first start. So we can start it up, make sure the temperature gauges are all sensing and that kind of stuff.
Huh. Well.
Might happen.
I'm sure it will. It will. The way that you're going right now, the way you've got progress going, I think you're on the right track and it'll go that way.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's kind of a milestone. It's like the engine runs. I mean, it's like, why isn't it flying? I mean, there can't be much left to do.
There's always more. You never stop working on them. It's just a matter of when can you get that first flight in, get that inspection done and get that first flight. And there's always more to do.
I've had all the control services connected and working. And you know, got all the wiring connected and working and the engine will run. I guess I'll have to put a seat in it then. That'll be the next priority.
All right.
But yeah, it should be getting close.
Tell you what, Mark, this has been absolutely wonderful. I feel like I've gotten to know you even better than I've known you over the last, 10 years now that we've known each other? I mean, it's...
10 or 15, yeah.
I mean, it's been great. And you're an asset to the chapter. You've always been there. You've always helped out. I tell you, it's going to be wonderful to see you fly that velocity. And I hope someday I can beg for a ride. It would be wonderful.
Yeah. We'll have to set a date at the Arlington Air Show or something.
There we go.
Yeah.
There we go. Hey, thanks for coming down to the studios, Mark. And all the best to you on your first flight on that velocity.
Thank you.
All right.
Looking forward to it.
And now the news for April 2023. Hey, the burger burn is back. This might be a premature burger burn, but with the extended evening hours, we're going to risk it. If you're hungry and in the mood for one of the chapter's famous burgers, show up around 5:30, and for a small donation to the chapter, you won't go hungry to the meeting. A reminder that the last burger is served no later than 6:30, and we always appreciate some help cleaning up. This month's speaker will be professional painter Brandon Knowles. Brandon is very well known in the auto painting world, with his work being showcased in dozens of magazine articles and several even being magazine covers. What many in the auto world don't know is that Brandon also paints airplanes. So show up 7:00, if you're not already there, to listen to Brandon's presentation on how to paint an airplane. Some really big news last month for the experimental amateur built world with the announcement of a new flight testing program. Resulting from a multi-year sustained advocacy effort by the EAA, this week the FAA published its guidelines for an optional task-based Phase 1 flight testing program. The program will primarily be an alternative to the standard 25 or 40-hour flight testing requirement for amateur-built aircraft, replacing the hours-based test period with a list of tasks to complete. The new guidance is housed in the recently updated Advisory Circular AC 90-89C, the Amateur-Built Aircraft and Ultralight Flight Testing Handbook. This is a wide-ranging document that the FAA first developed in partnership with the EAA back in 1989. The test-based program itself is found in Chapter 2 of the AC, beginning on pages 2 through 3. The program describes a series of 17 individual flight tests or tasks and recommends that the tests be flown per test cards carried in the aircraft. The program also requires the creation of an Aircraft Operating Handbook, or AOH, an alternative to the well-known POH. This is a result from the tests, which will benefit both the builder and any subsequent owners of the aircraft. I'm hoping that many of the chapter builders will take advantage of this new program and report back on their results. Well, that's a wrap for this month's podcast. Spread the word about EAA Chapter 84 podcast to your aviation friends and family. It's available for download on most popular apps, including Spotify, Apple, and Google. Make sure to hit that like button, subscribe, and give us a 5-star review. I would encourage you to go listen to previous podcasts, as there are now over 20 different interviews. I hope you'll remember to file a flight plan for next month's podcast. Be sure to find the latest news by following EAA Chapter 84 on social media apps like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Until next time, this has been your host, David Weber. And remember, stay off the brakes, keep moving forward.